ward, servants carrying the litter, the priests just behind, then Geraint leading the horse. Supported by her maid and the chamberlain, Bronwyn brought up the rear. The head priest gave Geraint a cold smile, then pointed to the lintel of the door.
"That head comes down today, or I won't bury your father."
Since he refused to order a servant to do such a hideous task, Geraint climbed the broch, working his way up the rough stone while the priest waited below with a basket. When Geraint reached the door, he clung to the lintel and examined the head. There was little left, a stretch of blackening skin over a skull, shreds of hair, a few cracked teeth.
"Well and good, Samaric. Both you and your old enemy are going to be buried today."
Geraint pulled his dagger and pried out the crumbling nails until the head dropped down into the priest's basket with a sickening little thud. The maidservant screamed. Then the ward was silent, except for the stamp and snort of the restless horse. The priests led the procession out and down around the hill to the small grove, the burial ground of the Falcon clan. At the sight of their mother's grave, Bronwyn began to weep. The fresh grave lay beside it, a deep trench, some 8 feet wide and 10 long. When Geraint let the horse up, it pulled at the reins and danced in fear, as if it knew the weird in store for it. Geraint threw the reins to a waiting servant. As the horse tossed up its head, Geraint drew his sword and struck, killing it cleanly with one blow to the throat. With a gush of blood, the horse staggered forward, its legs buckling, and fell headlong into the grave. Geraint stepped back and unthinkingly wiped the sword blade clean on his brigger. For the rest of the ceremony, he stood there with the sword in his hand because he never thought to sheathe it. At first, Geraint managed to cling to his warrior's calm, even when a sobbing Bronwyn poured milk and honey over their father's body. But at the first spadeful of earth, the dark mud settling over his father's face broke him. Keening, he fell to his knees, tossed his head back and sobbed that high, strange note over and over. Dimly, he felt Bronwyn's hands on his shoulders.
Geraint, please stop, please.
Geraint let her lead him away, leaning on her as if she were the warrior and he the lass. She took him back to the hall and shoved him into a chair by the hearth. He saw the priests come back, saw them fussing around Bronwyn and talking in low voices. She came over to him with a tankard of ale in her hand. Reflexively, Geraint took it, sipped from it, then nearly threw it in her face. It reeked of medicinal herbs.
"Drink it," Bronwyn snapped. "Drink it down, Geraint. You've got to sleep."
For her sake, Geraint choked the bitter stuff down. She took the empty tankard from his hands just as he fell asleep in his chair, drowning, or so he felt, in the warm sunlight. When he woke, he was lying on his bed with a torch burning in an iron sconce on the wall. Blaine was sitting on the floor and watching him.
"Ah, ye gods," Geraint said. "How long did I sleep?"
"It's just past sunset. We all rode in an hour or so ago. My mother and your betrothed wanted to be with Gwenny."
Blaine got up and poured water from the clay pitcher on the windowsill. Geraint drank greedily to wash the bitter aftertaste of the drug out of his mouth.
"How long will you set the period of mourning?" Blaine said.
"For my sake, I'd say a year, but that would be cruel to our sisters, wouldn't it? I can go on mourning after they're both married."
"Say to the turning of the fall, then."
Geraint nodded in agreement, thinking that Gwenny would be his for one more summer. Then he remembered why he would have the summer. Keening, he threw the clay cup against the wall so hard that it shattered. Blaine sat down beside him and grabbed him by the shoulders.
"Here, here, he's gone," Blaine said. "There's nothing more to do or say."
Geraint rested his head against Blaine's chest and wept.
"I love him like a brother," he thought. "I'll thank all the gods that Gwenny's not marrying him."
Prince Gowrion's first week back at court was one long frustration, with never a chance to speak to his father except in full formal court. He knew that he was holding back, too, letting slip a chance here and there, because his heart worried like a terrier with a rat at the question of marrying Bronwyn or letting Blaine have her. Finally, he decided to enlist the aid of the one ally he could always trust, his mother. On an afternoon so warm and balmy that it reminded him Beltane was close at hand, Gowrion left the city and rode out to find the Queen's hawking party, down by Loch Gwerchanith, the vast lake where three rivers came together west of Dunderverry. The Queen and her attendants were having their noon meal at the southern shore. In their bright dresses, the serving women and maidservants looked like flowers scattered through the grass. Queen Elena sat in their midst, and a young page, dressed in white, stood behind her, with the Queen's favourite little Merlin on his wrist. Off to one side, men servants tended the horses and other hawks. When Gowrion dismounted, the Queen waved him over with an impatient flick of her hand.
"I've hardly seen you since you rode home," Elena said. "Are you well?"
"By all means. What makes you think I'm not?"
"You've been brooding over summat. I can always tell."
The Queen turned to her women.
"Go down to the lake shore or such like, all of you. Leave us."
The women sprang up like birds taking flight and ran off, laughing and calling to one another. The page followed more slowly, chirruping to the hawk to keep it calm. Elena watched them go with a small satisfied nod. For all that she had four grown sons, she was a beautiful woman still, with large dark eyes, a slender face, and only a few streaks of grey in her chestnut hair. She reached into the basket behind her, brought out a piece of sweetbread, and handed it to Gowrion.
"My thanks. Tell me summat, mother. When you first came to court, did the other women envy your beauty?"
"Of course. Are you thinking about your betrothed?"
"Just that. I'm beginning to think you are right to doubt my choice."
"Now's a fine time for that when you've already pledged your vow to the poor child."
"What son ever listens to his mother until it's too late?"
Elena gave him an indulgent smile. Gowrion nibbled on the sweetbread and considered strategies.
"You know," Elena said, "there's not a lass alive who wouldn't want to be known as the most beautiful woman in all Deverry, but it's a harsh weird in its own way. Your little Gwenny never had the education I had, either. She's such a trusting little soul."
"Just that. I spoke with Lady Rotha of the Boar about the matter, too, when I went with Geraint for his betrothal. Lord Blaine of the Boar is much enamoured of the lass."
"Indeed? And does that mean trouble coming?"
"It doesn't, but only because Blaine is an honourable man. It's odd, truly. Most lords care naught about their wives one way or another, just so long as they bear sons."
"Great beauty can act on the roughest lord like Dweoma."
Elena smiled briefly. "Or on a prince." Gowrion winced at her unfortunate choice of imagery.
"What are you scheming?" Elena went on. "Leaving Gwenny to Blaine and finding another wife?"
"Well, somewhat like that. There's one small difficulty to that plan. I still love her, in my way."
"Love may be a luxury that a prince can't afford. I don't remember Blaine well from his few visits to court. Is he like his father?"
"As different as mead from mud."
"Then that's one blessing. I'm sure that if his father hadn't been killed in that hunting accident, he'd be plotting against the king right now."
Elena glanced away, sincerely troubled. The Deverry kingship was a risky thing. The lords and tyrants remembered well that in the old days of the Dawn Time, kings were elected from among their fellow nobles, and families held the throne only as long as their heirs held the respect of the lords. Under the pressures of colonizing the new kingdom, that custom had died away hundreds of years before, but it was far from unknown for the nobility to organize a rebellion against an unpopular king in order to replace him with a better one.
"Lady Rother assures me that Blaine will hold loyal," Gowrion said.
"Indeed? Well, I respect her opinion. You truly don't want to give Bronwyn up, do you?"
"I don't know."
Gowrion tossed the remains of the bread into the grass.
"I truly don't know."
"Here's somewhat else you might think about. Your eldest brother has always been far too fond of the lasses as it is."
All at once Gowrion found himself standing, his hand on his sword hilt.
"I'd kill him if he laid one hand on my Gwenny. My apologies, mother, but I'd kill him."
Her face pale, Elena rose and caught his arm. Gowrion let go of the hilt and calmed himself.
"Think about this marriage carefully," Elena said, her voice shaking. "I beg you, think carefully."
"I will, and my apologies."
Her talk with the prince seemed to have spoiled the queen's pleasure in her hawking, because she called her servants to her and announced that they were returning to the city. At that time, Dunderverry was confined to a low rise about a mile from the marshy shores of Loch Gwerconeth. Ringed with stone walls, it lay on both sides of a rushing river, which was spanned by two stone bridges, as well as two defensible arches in the city walls. Clustered inside were round stone houses, scattered along randomly curving streets that sheltered about 20,000 people. At either end of the city were two small hills. The southern one bore the great Temple of Bel, the palace of the High Priest of the kingdom, and an oak grove. The northern hill held the royal compound, which had stood there in one form or another for 600 years. Gowrion's clan, the Wyvern, had been living on the royal hill for only 48 years. Gowrion's grandfather, Adoric I, had ended a long period of anarchy by finally winning a war among the great clans over the kingship. Although the Wyvern was descended from a member of King Bran's original warband and thus was entitled to be called a great clan, Adoric I had forged an alliance among the lesser clans, the merchants, and anyone else who'd support his claim to the throne. Although he'd been scorned for stooping so low, he'd also taken the victory. As the Queen's party rode through the streets, the townsfolk bowed and cheered her. No matter what they might have thought of her husband in private, they honestly loved Elena, who'd endowed many a temple to give aid to the poor, and who spoke up often for a poor man to make the king show him mercy. For all his thick-headedness, the king did know what a treasure he had in his wife. She was the only person whose advice he would take and trust, at least when it suited him to do so. Gowrion's main hope lay in getting her to advise the king to let his third son leave court for the Dwayoma. Soon, he knew, he would have to tell his mother the truth. A stone wall with iron-bound gates ringed the bottom of the royal hill. Beyond was a grassy parkland, where white, red-eared cattle grazed along with the royal horses. Near the crest stood a second ring of walls, sheltering a village within the city, the royal compound, the huts for servants, sheds, stables, barracks and the like. In the middle of this clutter and bustle rose the great brock of the Wyvern clan. The main building was a 6-story tower. Around it clustered 3 2-story half-towers, like chicks nestling around a hen. In case of fighting, the brock would become a slaughterhouse for the baffled enemy, because the only way into the half-towers lay through the main one. Besides the king and his family, the brock complex housed all the noble-born retainers of the court, in a virtual rabbit warren of corridors and small wedge-shaped chambers, where constant intrigues and scheming over power and the king's favour were a way of life, not only for the retainers, but for the various princes and their wives. Getting out of that brock had always been the consummate goal of Gowrion's life. As befitted a prince, Gowrion had a suite of rooms on the second floor of the main tower. His reception chamber took up a generous wedge of the round floor plan, with a high beamed ceiling, a stone hearth, and a polished wooden floor. On the wood-panelled walls hung fine tapestries from the far-off land of Bardek, gifts from various traders who hoped that the prince would speak of them to the king. Since he was honourable in his bribe-taking, Gowrion always dutifully spoke. The chamber was richly furnished with carved chests, a cushioned chair, and a table where stood, between bronze wyverns, his greatest treasure, 7 books. When Gowrion had first learned to read, the king was furious, raging that letters were no fit thing for a man. But in his usual stubborn way, Gowrion had persevered until now, after some 4 years of study, he could read almost as well as a scribe. To avoid the bustle and clamour of the formal dinner in the great hall, Gowrion dined privately in his chamber that night. He did, however, receive a guest after the meal to share a silver goblet of mead, Gwerbret Madoc of Glasloch, in whose jurisdiction lay the lands of the Falcon and the Boar. Although below members of the royal family, of course, the rank of Gwerbret was the highest in the kingdom, and the title went back to ancient times. In the Gaulish homeland, the Dawntime tribes elected magistrates called Virgobreti to administer their laws and to speak for the wartime assemblies. Generally, the Virgobreti were chosen from the noble-born, and at about the time that word became Gwerbret in their new land of Deveri, the position began to pass from father to son.
Since a man who made judgments and distributed booty was in a good position to build up his power, in time the Guebrets became great, wealthy, and in possession of small armies to enforce their legal rulings on the tyrants and lords beneath them. One last remnant of the dawn time survived, however, in the council of electors who, if a Guebret's line died out, would choose the noble clan to succeed it. Thus, every Guebret in the kingdom was a force to be reckoned with, and Gowrion fussed over Madoc as if he were a prince himself, offering him the cushioned chair, pouring him mead with his own hands, and sending the page away so that they could speak privately. The object of these attentions merely smiled benignly. A solid man with a thick streak of grey in his raven-dark hair, Madoc cared more for fine horses than honours, and for a good battle more than rank. That night he was in a jesting mood, pledging the prince with his goblet of mead in mock solemnity.
"To your wedding, my prince," Madoc said. "For a man who doesn't say much, you're a sly one. Fancy you nipping in and getting the most beautiful lass in the kingdom." "I was rather surprised she accepted me. No one could ever call me the most beautiful lad." "Oh, don't give yourself short value. Bronwyn sees beyond a lad's face, which is more than many a lass does."
Madoc had a swallow of mead, long enough to burn an ordinary drinker's throat.
"I don't mind saying that every man in the kingdom is going to envy you your wedding night. Or have you already claimed your rights as her betrothed?" "I haven't. I had no desire to set her brother against me just for one night in her bed."
Although Gowrion was merely speaking casually, Madoc turned troubled, watching him over the rim of his goblet.
"Well," Gowrion went on, "how do you think Geraint would have taken it if I'd bedded his sister under his roof?" "He's a strange lad."
Madoc looked idly away.
"He's been out there alone on the edge of that cursed forest too much, but he's a good lad withal. I rode with him in that last rebellion against your father. By the Hell Ice itself, our Gero can fight. I've never seen a man swing a sword as well as he does, and that's not idle praise, my prince, but my considered judgment." "Then coming from you, that's high praise indeed."
Madoc nodded absently and had another sip of mead. When he spoke again, it was to change the subject to the legal doings of his Guebrethian, and he kept it there. It was late, and Madoc long gone, when a page came with a summons from the king. Since the king scorned luxury as unfit for a fighting man, even a regal one, his large chamber was perfectly plain, with the torches in their iron sconces the only decoration on the stone walls. Near the hearth, where a small fire burned to ward off the spring chill, King Adoric was sitting on a plain wooden chair, with Elena beside him on a footstool. When Gowrion came in, the king stood up, setting his hands on his hips. Adoric II was a massive man, broad-shouldered, tall, with a bull's neck and a perpetually ruddy face. His grey hair and thick moustache were still touched with blonde.
"So, you young cub, I've got summat to say to you."
"Indeed, my liege?"
"Indeed. What by all the hells have you been doing out in the forest with that daft old man?"
Caught off guard, Gowrion could only stare at him.
"Don't you think I have you followed?" Adoric went on. "You may be fool enough to ride alone, but I'm not fool enough to let you." "Curse your very soul," Gowrion snapped, "spying on me. Listen to your insolent little hound."
Adoric glanced at Elena.
"Cursing his own father. But answer me, lad. What have you been doing? The village folk tell my men that this Hregor is a daft old herbman. I can get you an apothecary if the prince has royal boils or such like."
Gowrion knew that the moment had come for truth, even though he had never been less willing to tell it in his life.
"He earns his living with his herbs, sure enough. But he's a Dwayoma master."
Elena caught her breath in an audible gasp.
"Horse dung!"
Adoric snarled.
"Do you truly think I'll believe such babble? I want to know what you're doing, spending so much time with him when you tell me you're at the Falcon Dun."
"Studying with him. Why shouldn't a prince study the Dwayoma?"
"Ah, ye gods!" Elena burst out. "I've always known you'd leave me for that."
Adoric turned to stare his wife into silence.
"Why not?"
the king said.
Why not? Because I forbid it.
Oh, here, you just called it horse dung. Why are you raging now?
Swinging too fast to be dodged, Adoric slapped him hard across the face. When Elena cried out, Adoric turned on her.
Get out of here, woman, now!
Elena fled through the curtained archway that led to the woman's hall. Adoric drew his dagger, then stabbed it into the back of a chair so hard that when he took his hand away, the dagger quivered for a moment. Galrion held his ground and stared steadily at him.
I want a vow out of you, Adoric said. A solemn vow that you'll never touch this nonsense again.
Never could I lie to my own father, so I can't swear it.
Adoric slapped him backhanded.
By the names of the gods, father, what do you hold so much against it?
What any man would hold, whose stomach wouldn't turn at summit unclean.
It's not unclean. That's a tale the priests make up to frighten women away from witchcraft.
The barb hit its mark. Adoric made a visible effort to be calm.
I can't give it up, Galrion went on. It's too late. I know too much already for it to let me rest.
When Adoric took a sharp step back, Galrion finally realized that his father was afraid, and him a man who would ride straight into a hopeless battle and take no quarter from man or god.
Just what do you know?
The king whispered. Galrion had Horego's permission to display one small trick to persuade his father. He raised his hand and imagined that it was glowing with blue fire. Only when the image lived, no matter where he turned his mind, did he call upon the wild folk of Aether, who rushed to do his bidding and bring the blue light through to the physical plane, where it flared up and raged round his fingers. Adoric flung himself back, his arm over his face as if to ward a blow.
Stop it!
Adoric bellowed out.
I say stop it!
Galrion forced the fire away just as the king's guard flung open the door and rushed into the chamber with drawn swords. Adoric pulled himself together with a will almost as strong as his son's.
You can all go.
Adoric smiled impartially all round.
My thanks, but I'm only arguing with the stubbornest whelp in the litter.
The captain of the guard bowed, glancing Galrion's way with a wink. As soon as the men were gone and the door shut, Adoric pulled the dagger free of the chair back.
I'm half-minded to slit your throat and put a clean end to this,
Adoric remarked in a casual tone of voice.
Don't you ever do that round me again.
I won't then, but it makes a handy thing on a dark night when you've dropped your torch.
Hold your tongue!
Adoric clutched the dagger tight.
To think a son of mine, and as cold as ice about it.
But ye gods, father, can't you see? It's too late to go back. I want to leave the court and study. There's no other road open to me.
Adoric held the dagger so that the blade caught the torchlight.
Get out,
Adoric whispered.
Get out of my presence before I do a dishonorable thing.
Galrion turned and walked slowly toward the door. The flesh on his back prickled. Once he was safely out, Galrion allowed himself one long sigh of relief that the dagger was still in his father's hand, not in his back. On the morrow, Galrion went early in search of his mother, but he found her talking urgently with her serving women. To pass the time until he could speak with her, he decided to go for a walk through the parkland. As he walked down the hill to the first gate, he was thinking that it should have come as no surprise that the king would fear a prince with Dwayoma. Adoric feared every possible rival to his throne. If Galrion had been a schemer, there was no doubt that magic would have given him a powerful edge. At the gate, two guards stepped forward and blocked his path.
My humble apologies, my prince. The king's given orders that you not be allowed to pass by.
Oh, has he now? And would you raise your hand to stop me?
My apologies, my prince.
The guard licked nervous lips.
But at the king's orders, I would.
Galrion stalked back to the broch, determined to have it out with his father over this insult, no matter what it cost him. As he strode down the corridors, servants scattered in front of him like frightened birds. Galrion slammed into the council chamber, knocked aside a page who tried to stop him, and found the king standing by the window and talking with a dusty, travel-stained lad who knelt at the king's feet.
Well and good,
Adoric was saying.
Tomorrow you can take back the message of condolences to Lord Geraint. Our heart sorrows for the falcon.
Only then did Gowrion recognize one of the pages from the falcon Dun.
Ah, ye gods, he thought, Dwen is dead.
All at once, he felt his subtle plans slipping away from him, just as when a child builds a tower out of bits of wood, only to see it tumble down at the first breath of wind.
And here is the prince,
Adoric said.
Does your lord have any message of import for him?
He does, your highness. My prince, Lord Geraint, has set the period of mourning until the turning of the fall. He humbly begs your understanding on this matter.
He has it, truly. Come to me before you return to the falcon. I'll give you a message for my lady. Adoric dismissed the page in the care of another. Once they were alone, the king dropped his false civility.
So? You seem to know what's going on well enough. Did your foul Dweilmer show you Dwen's death?
It did, but I never thought it would come so soon.
The king's face first paled, then went scarlet, but Gowrion got his thrust in first.
Why have you told the guards to keep me in?
Why do you think? I'm not having you ride out of here on the sly to your cursed old hermit. Here, this evil news of Lord Dwen made me remember your betrothed. What were you planning on doing? Marrying her and taking her to a hut in the forest while you dabble about with spells?
Just that, if she'll go.
You stinking dog!
Adoric's mouth moved, seeking insults.
You arrogant little—
Oh, here, where do I get my arrogance but from you? Why shouldn't a woman follow where her man wills to go?
No reason in the world, unless she's the noble-born daughter of a great clan.
Adoric stepped closer.
You ugly little dolt. Haven't you thought of the insult to the falcon? Geraint's uncle died for the sake of our throne, and now you dare to treat their kin this way? Do you want to drive them to rebellion?
He gave Gowrion a backhanded slap.
Get out of my sight. I don't want to see you until you've gotten sense into your head.
Gowrion stalked back to his chamber, slammed the door behind him, and flung himself down into his chair to think. There was nothing for it now but to break his betrothal. But the king would never allow that insult to the falcon either.
I could slip away somehow, Gowrion thought. Climb the walls at night and be in the forest before they catch me. And break Gwenny's heart by deserting her without even a message to explain.
He had the horrible feeling that Hrega was going to be displeased by the way he was handling things.
With the period of mourning, you've got time, he told himself.
At the thought, the Dweilmer warning flared up so strongly that he shivered. For some reason that the Dweilmer couldn't tell him, there was no time at all. Gowrion got up and paced over to the window. When he looked down, he saw two armed guards standing at the foot of the broch directly below his window. Gowrion rushed to his door and flung it open to find four more guards in the corridor. The captain managed to give him a sickly smile.
My apologies, my prince. The king orders that you remain in your chamber. We're only allowed to let your page through.
Gowrion slammed the door and returned to his chair. He wondered how long the king would make him wait before summoning him. 4 days, it turned out. 4 tedious days with no company but his books and his page, who brought him food and took away the leavings silently, furtively, because servants of an out-of-favour master often met ill ends at court. Every now and then, Gowrion would open the door and chat with the guards, who were friendly enough, being as their place was secure no matter what happened to the prince. Once, Gowrion sent a message to the queen and begged her to come see him. The answer came back that she didn't dare. Finally, on the 4th night, the guards announced that they were taking him to the king. When they marched Gowrion into the royal chamber, Adoric dismissed them. There was no sign of Elaena.
Very well. Have you had time to think about swearing me that vow? Leave this Dweilmer nonsense behind, and everything will be as it was before.
Father, believe me, I have no choice but to say you nay. I can't leave the Dweilmer because it won't leave me. It's not like breaking your sword and retiring to the temple.
So, you've got plenty of fancy words to justify disobeying the king, do you? For your mother's sake, I'll give you one last chance. We'll see what Bronwyn can do to talk you round.
Are you going to pen me like a hog till autumn?
I'm sending for her to come to court. Curse the morning.
I'm sending a speeded courier to Lord Geraint tomorrow. My apologies will go with him, but I want them both here as fast as they can ride. I'm going to tell Lady Bronwyn what her dolt of a betrothed is planning on doing, and I'll order her to talk you round.
And if she can't?
Then neither of you will ever leave the palace. Ever.
Gowrion nearly wept. Never leave. Never ride through his beloved forest again. Never see the snow hanging thick on leafless branch, nor a river in spate. Never. And Bronwyn, too, would be shut up as a prisoner for years, all for her husband's fault. Then, only then, when it seemed too late for them both, did he realize that he truly loved her, not just her god-cursed beauty, but her. That night Gowrion had no hope of sleep. He paced back and forth in his chambers, his mind a confused babble of dread, remorse, and futile schemes of escape. It would take a hard-riding courier 3 days to reach the Falcon, then another 5 for Bronwyn and Geraint to reach Dunderveri.
I'll have to meet them on the road, he thought, if I can get out of the best-guarded fortress in the kingdom.
His Dwayoma could never help him. He was the merest apprentice, with only an apprentice's feeble tricks at his disposal.
A little knowledge, a few wretched herbs,
Gowrion reproached himself.
You'll know better than a woman dabbling in witchcraft.
All at once his plan came to him, and he laughed aloud. But he would need help. As much as he hated to put her at risk, he had no one to turn to but the Queen. In the morning, Gowrion sent his page to Elena with the urgent message that she come see him. She sent back the answer that she would try, but it depended on the King's whim. For 3 days Gowrion waited, counting in his mind every mile that the King's courier was riding, closer and closer to the Falcon Keep. Finally, he sent the page with a pair of torn brigger and the request that his mother's servants mend them. Such an errand would allay the king's suspicions, if indeed he ever heard of anything so trivial. The ruse worked. On the next morning, the queen herself brought the mended brigger back, slipping into his room like a servant lass.
Mother, Gowrion said, do you know the king's plan?
I do, and I weep for little Bronwyn as much as you.
Weep for her more, because I'm unworthy of her. Here, will you help me for her sake? All I ask is this. If I give you some clothes to mend, will you take them and have your maids leave them out in the women's hall tonight? Tell them to put them on the table by the door.
I will.
Elena shuddered lightly.
I don't dare no more. After the noon meal, when the guards were bound to be bored with their light duty, Gowrion opened his door for a chat. His luck was with him. They were sitting on the floor and playing dice for coppers.
Can I join you? If I sit on this side of the doorway, we won't be breaking the king's orders.
Obligingly, the guards moved their game closer. Normally, Gowrion never wagered on the dice, simply because his Dwayoma sight would always tell him which way they would fall. Now, to get sympathy from his guards, he used the sight to place his bets so that he lost.
By ever God and his wife, the captain said finally. Your luck is bad today, my prince. How could it be otherwise? It's been against me for weeks now. If you've ever envied the prince, let this be a lesson for you. It's a hard thing to fall from your own father's favour.
The captain nodded in melancholy agreement.
I don't mind telling you, my prince, that I think I'd go daft, shut up like you are. I'm close to it, and the nights are more wearisome than the days, because I can't sleep. Oh, here. I know the king's orders allow you to bring me things. Would that hold true of a woman? I don't see why not.
The captain shed a grin with his men.
Is there one of your mother's maids you fancy? Do you know May, the golden-haired lass? She's taken a tumble with me before this. Well and good, then. We'll do our best to smuggle her in tonight, when things are all quiet-like.
At the dinner hour, Gowrion had his page bring him a flagon of mead and 2 goblets. He dug down into a chest and found his packets of dried herbs. Rhaegar was teaching him simple herbcraft, and he'd brought his student work home mostly as a pleasant reminder of his days in the forest. Now he had a real need for that packet of valerian, the most potent soporific in a herbman's stock. He ground up only a spare dose. He had no desire to make May ill with too much. And besides, the musty, thick taste of the herb could give his whole game away.
Toward midnight, Gowrion heard May giggling in the corridor and the captain telling her to hush. He opened the door and saw that she was wearing a cloak with the hood up to hide her face, exactly as he'd hoped.
"Greetings, my sweet. How kind you are to a dishonored man."
When May giggled, Gowrion clapped his hand over her mouth in pretend alarm.
"Keep her quiet when you take her back, will you?"
Gowrion said to the captain.
"Hear that, lass," the captain said. "Not one word out of you on the way back."
May nodded, her big blue eyes as solemn as a child's when it's been let into a secret. Gowrion ushered her inside and barred the door behind them. May took off her cloak, revealing a loose, flowing dress, loose enough, Gowrion thought, to fit his shoulders nicely. He'd chosen her deliberately because she was tall for a lass.
"I've had the page bring us mead. Sit and drink with me a while."
"You're always so gallant, my prince. It aches my heart to see you out of favour."
"My thanks. And what about my marriage? Does that ache your heart too?"
May merely shrugged and followed him into the bedchamber. Gowrion handed her the drugged goblet, then took a sip from his own, a gesture that automatically made her sip hers. They sat down together on the edge of the bed.
"Ah, well, we've had our good times, and a prince marries where the kingdom needs him to."
May grinned, winking.
"I only hope your new wife never hears of me."
"Oh, here, you must have a new man to be so agreeable."
May had another long swallow of the mead and winked again.
"Maybe I do, maybe I don't, but no one will find out where I've been tonight. And so what if he does? He won't be arguing with the prince, I'll wager, even if you are out of favour for now."
She had still another sip.
"These bad times will pass, my prince. Your mother's ever so upset, but she'll talk the king round."
"So I hope."
May yawned, shaking her head, then had a sip of mead.
"This mead tastes so sweet," she said. "It's awfully good."
"Only the best for you. Drink that up and we'll have a bit more."
A bit more proved unnecessary. By the time she had finished that first goblet, May was yawning, shutting her eyes, then forcing them open. When she leaned over to set the goblet on the table beside the bed, she dropped it. Gowrion grabbed her just as she fell forward into his arms. Gowrion undressed her, tucked her up comfortably in his bed, then got out the packet of herbs and left it by her goblet to make it clear that she'd been drugged, an unwilling accomplice. He paced restlessly around, letting enough time lapse to satisfy the guards. When he could bear to wait no longer, he changed into her clothes, drew the hood of the cloak around his face, and slipped out into the hall. Suspecting nothing, the guards gave him a leer and a wink, then escorted him along the dark corridors. At the door of the women's hall, the captain gave him a friendly pat on the behind, told him that he was a good lass, and gallantly opened the door for him. Dim moonlight filtered through the windows of the silent room. Gowrion found the table, his clothes, and a dagger in a sheath left under his brigger. Thanking his mother in his heart, he changed into his clothes and settled the dagger inside his shirt. When he looked out, the ward below was empty. Carefully, he edged out onto the window ledge, turned precariously, and started down the rough stonework. Praying that no one would walk by, he clambered down, his hands aching and bleeding on the stone, until at last he reached the ward. Gowrion ran from hut to hut and shed to shed until he reached the stables. Abutting directly on the wall was a storage shed that he could climb easily. He swung from the roof to the wall, then crawled on his stomach until he reached a place where an oak grew on the far side. He swung into the branches, climbed down, then lingered in the safe shadows. He could see down the long slope of parkland to the outer ring, where, against the starry sky, moved the dark shapes of the night guards patrolling the ramparts. The most dangerous part of the escape lay ahead. Gowrion circled the inner ring until he could see the road leading down to the outer gates. He crawled downhill in the long grass until he was out of sight of the guard at the inner gates, then stood up and boldly walked down the road. When he came close to the guard station, he broke into a run.
"Here!"
Gowrion made his voice as high and unsteady as a lad's.
"Open up! An errand for the cook!"
"Hold, lad!"
A guard stepped forward to peer at him in the darkness.
"That's a likely tale."
"Nertha's having her child," Gowrion said. "And it's bad. The midwife needs the apothecary. Please hurry."
"That's the kitchen wench," another guard called out. "She's been heavy for weeks now."
Hardly daring to believe in his success, Galrion raced through the postern gate and kept running until he was well into the silent city. He crouched among some empty ale barrels behind a tavern and caught his breath while he considered his next move. Not the best trick in the world would get him past the guards at the city gates, but the river flowed through the arches in the walls without asking anyone's permission. Cautiously, he stood up and began slipping through the alleys behind the buildings. He was halfway to the river when he heard footsteps behind him. He flung himself into a doorway and crouched in the shadows as a pair of drunken riders from the king's warband staggered past. They went more than 2 yards beyond him when one of them burst out singing at the top of his lungs. Galrion cursed him and prayed that the city guards wouldn't come running to deal with the nuisance. At last the riders were gone, and the streets silent again. With a constant eye out for trouble, Galrion made his way down to the river bank and waded out to the deep part of the channel. As he let the current take him, he saw far above guards pacing back and forth on the city wall. Closer, closer, the river was sweeping him along fast to the point where they might look down and see him. He held his breath and plunged down deep. In the murky water it was hard to see, but he thought he saw the darker stone of the arches sweep by him. His lungs ached, began to burn like fire, but he forced himself to stay down until the desperate pain drove him, panting and gasping, to the surface. He swung himself over on his back like a seal and barely swam while he breathed in the blessed air. The guards and city both lay far behind him, and no one else was out on the river bank. Galrion made his way to the bank and crawled out under a copse of willow trees.
"Free," he thought. "Now all I've got to do is get to Bronwyn."
Galrion wrung the worst of the water out of his clothes and put them back on, damp. The sky told him that he had about 5 hours till dawn. His page wouldn't find May for about another hour after that, and there was bound to be another hour's confusion before the king's warband rode out to hunt him down. It wasn't much of a lead, but if he could only reach the wild forest, they would never find him. He knew the tracks through it, while the riders would be blundering around, making too much noise to surprise any kind of game. Galrion set off across the meadows to the neighbouring farms, and the horse he had in mind to steal. It was an easy theft. He'd often ridden this way and stopped to admire the sleek bay gelding, who remembered his kind words and pats. When Galrion approached, the bay came right up and let him take its halter. Since there was no lead rein and no time to steal one, Galrion tore a strip of cloth off the bottom of his shirt and prayed that it would hold. The bay was well trained, responding to the touch of this improvised rein along its neck. Galrion set off at a gallop down the east running road. If the king's messenger wasn't already with Geraint, he would reach the falcon on the morrow. After a few minutes, he slowed the bay to a walk to save its strength. Alternately walking and trotting in short bursts, they travelled all night and reached, just at dawn, the border of the king's personal domain. Galrion turned south, heading for the wild heath to avoid the well-travelled road. On this roundabout route it would take longer to reach the forest, but he had no choice. By noon the horse was weary and stumbling under him. Galrion dismounted and led it along until they came to an unkempt woodland on the edge of pastureland. He found a stream and let the bay drink. It was when the bay began grazing on the grassy bank that Galrion realized he was starving. In his hurry, he'd forgotten to bring any coin, not so much as a copper. He could no longer ride up to a noble lord's door and expect to be fed simply because he was a prince.
"I'm not quite as clever as I need to be," he said to the horse. "Well, I wonder how you go about stealing food from farmers."
The horse needed to rest, and Galrion was weaving with exhaustion. Letting the improvised halter rope trail for want of a proper tether, he left the horse to its grass, then sat down with his back to a tree. Although he told himself that he would rest only for an hour, when he woke it was late in the afternoon, and he heard voices nearby. He jumped to his feet and pulled the dagger out of his shirt.
"We don't know whose it is," a man was saying. "A stolen horse from the look of this bit of cloth."
Galrion crept through the trees and came upon a farmer and a young lad who was holding the bay by the halter. When the horse saw Galrion, it nickered out a greeting. The farmer spun round, raising his heavy staff.
"You!" he called out. "Do you claim this horse?"
I do.
Gowrion stepped out of cover. The lad started urging the horse out of the way, but he kept frightened eyes on his father and this dirty, dangerous stranger. When Gowrion took a step forward, the farmer dropped to a fighting crouch. Gowrion took another step, then another. All at once, the farmer laughed, dropped the staff, and knelt at the prince's feet.
"By the sun and his rays, my liege," the farmer said. "So you're out of the palace. I didn't recognize you at first."
"I'm out indeed. How do you know so much?"
"What's better gossip than the doings of the king? Truly, my prince, the news of your disgrace is all over the marketplace. Everyone's as sad for your mother's sake, her such a good woman and all."
"She is at that. Will you help me for her sake? All I ask is a bit of rope for this halter and a meal."
"Done. But I've got a bridle to spare."
The farmer rose, dusting dead leaves off his knees.
"The king's war band rode by on the east road today. The tailor's daughter saw them when she went out to pick violets."
The farmer was even better than his word. Not only did he give the prince the bridle and a hot dinner, but he insisted on packing a sack of loaves of bread, dried apples, and oats for the gelding. More food, no doubt, than he could truly spare. When Gowrion left at nightfall, he was sure that the king's men would hear nothing but lies from this loyal man. It hardly mattered what the farmer would have told them, if indeed they did ride his way, because by mid-morning of the next day, Gowrion led his weary horse into the virgin forest. He found water, gave the horse a meagre ration of oats, then sat down to think. He was tempted simply to go to Hrega and let Bronwyn think what she liked about him, but he had the distinct feeling that Hrega would be furious. For the first time in his pampered life, Gowrion knew what it was to fail. He'd been a fool, dishonourable, plain and simply stupid. He cursed himself with every insult he could think of. Around him the forest stretched silent, dappled with sunlight, indifferent to him and his short-lived human worries. Husbanding every scrap of food, scrounging what fodder he could for his horse, Gowrion made his way east through the forest for 2 days. He stayed close to the road and tried to calculate where the Falcon's party might be, because he'd made up his mind to intercept it. Late one afternoon, he risked coming out onto the road and riding up to the crest of a low hill. Far away, hanging over the road, was a faint pall of dust, horses coming. Hurriedly, he pulled back into the forest and waited, but the Falcon's party never rode past. With Bronwyn and her maidservants along, they would be making early camps to spare the women's strength. As it grew dark, Gowrion led the bay through the forest and worked his way toward the camp. From the top of the next hill he saw it, not just Lord Geraint and his retainers, but the king's entire warband.
"May every god curse them," Gowrion whispered. "They knew she'd be the best bait to draw me."
Gowrion tied his horse securely in the woods, then ran across the road and began making his cautious way to the camp. Every snap of a twig under his foot made him freeze and wait. Halfway downhill, the trees thinned somewhat, giving him a good look at the sprawling, disorganized camp. In the clearing along the stream, horses were tethered. Nearby, the warband was gathered round 2 fires. Off to one side, among the trees, stood a high-peat canvas tent, doubtless for Bronwyn's privacy, away from the ill-mannered riders. The true and dangerous question, of course, was where Geraint might be. The firelight below was too dim for Gowrion to make out anyone's face. He lay flat in the underbrush and watched until after about an hour, a blond man came out of the tent and strolled over to one of the fires. No man but her brother would have been allowed in that tent in the first place. As soon as Geraint was safely occupied with his dinner, Gowrion got up, drawing his dagger, then circled through the underbrush, moving downhill and heading for the tent. The warband was laughing and talking, making blessed noise to cover his approach. Gowrion slipped the tent down the back with his dagger, a rip of taut cloth. He heard someone moving inside.
"Gowrion,"
Bronwyn whispered.
"It is."
Gowrion slipped back into cover. Wearing only her long nightdress, her golden hair loose over her shoulders, Bronwyn crawled out the rip and crept to join him.
"I knew you'd come for me," she whispered. "We've got to go right now."
"Are ye gods? Will you come with me?"
Did you ever doubt it? I'd follow you anywhere. I don't care what you've done.
But you don't even have a scrap of extra clothing.
Do you think that matters to me?
Gowrion felt as if he'd never truly looked at her before. His poor, weak child, grinning like a berserker at the thought of riding away with an exile.
Forgive me, Gowrion said. Come along, I've got a horse.
Then Gowrion heard the sound, the softest crack of a branch.
Run!
Bronwyn screamed. Gowrion swirled round, too late. The guard sprang out of the trees and circled him like a cornered stag. Gowrion dropped to a fighting crouch, raised the dagger and promised himself he'd get one of them before he died. A man shoved his way through the pack of guards.
"That'll do you no good, lad," a Doric said.
Gowrion straightened up. He could never kill his own father. When he threw the dagger onto the ground at a Doric's feet, the king stooped and retrieved it, his smile as cold as the winter wind. Gowrion heard Bronwyn behind him, weeping in long sobs, and Geraint's voice murmuring as he tried to comfort her.
"Nothing like a bitch to bring a dog to heel," a Doric remarked. "Bring him round to the fire. I want to look at this cub of mine."
The guards marched Gowrion around the tent and over to the bigger campfire, where the king took up his stance, feet spread apart, hands on hips. When someone brought Bronwyn a cloak, she wrapped it around her and stared hopelessly at Gowrion. Geraint laid a heavy hand on her shoulder and drew her close.
"So, you little whelp," a Doric said. "What do you have to say for yourself?"
"Naught, father. I'll only ask you for a single boon."
"What makes you think you have the right to ask for any?"
A Doric drew his own dagger and began to fiddle with it as he talked.
"No right at all. But I'm asking for my lady's sake. Send her away out of sight before you kill me."
"Fair enough. Granted."
Bronwyn screamed, shoved Geraint so hard that he stumbled, and ran forward to throw herself at the king's feet.
"Please, please,"
Bronwyn went on.
"For the sake of his mother, I beg you. If you must have blood, take mine."
Bronwyn clutched the hem of the king's shirt and turned her throat up to him. She was so beautiful, with her hair streaming down her shoulders, with tears running down her perfect face, that even the king's riders sighed aloud in pity for her.
"Ah, ye gods," a Doric said. "Do you love this lout as much as that?"
"I do. I go with him anywhere, even to the other lands."
A Doric glanced at the dagger, then sheathed it with a sigh.
"Great!"
the king bellowed. Geraint came forward, took Bronwyn by the shoulders and tried to lead her away, but she shook him off. Gowrion was so sick he could barely stand. He was unworthy of her, or so he saw it, and this second failure shattered him.
"Well, by the hells," a Doric said mildly. "If I can't slit your throat, Gowrion, how am I going to solve this little matter?"
"You could let me and my lady go into exile. It would spare us all much trouble."
"You little bastard!"
A Doric stepped forward and slapped him across the face.
"How dare you!"
Gowrion staggered from the force of the blow, but he held his ground.
"Do you want me to tell everyone else what this quarrel between us is all about? Do you, father? I will."
A Doric went as still as a hunted animal.
"Or shall I just accept exile?"
Gowrion went on.
"And no man need know the cause of it."
"You bastard!"
A Doric whispered so low that Gowrion could barely hear him.
"Or truly not a bastard, because of all my sons you're the one most like me."
Then he raised his voice.
"The cause need not be known. But we hereby do pronounce our son Gowrion as stripped of all his rank and honour, as turned out of our presence and our domain for ever and beyond for ever. We forbid him our lands. We forbid him the shelter of those sworn to us as loyal vassals, all on pain of death."
He paused to laugh under his breath.
"And we hereby strip him of the name we gave him at his miserable birth. We proclaim his new name as Nevin. Do you hear me, lad? Nevin. No one. Nobody at all. That's your new name."
done. I'll bear it proudly.
Bronwyn shook herself free of Geraint's arm. She smiled as proudly as the princess she might have been as she started over to her banished man. Galrion held out his hand to her.
Hold!
Geraint forced himself between them.
My liege, my king, what is this? Am I to marry my only sister to an exile?
She's my betrothed already, Galrion snapped. Your father pledged her, not you.
Hold your tongue, Nevin!
Adoric slapped him across the face.
My lord Geraint, you have our leave to speak.
My liege.
As he knelt before the king, Geraint was shaking.
Truly, my father pledged her, and as his son all I can do is honour the pledge. But my father betrothed her to a good life, one of comfort and honour. He loved his daughter. What will she have now?
As Adoric considered, Galrion felt the Dwayoma warning like ice, shuddering down his back. He stepped forward.
Father! Never call me that again!
Adoric motioned to the guards.
Keep our no one here quiet!
Before Galrion could dodge, two men grabbed him and twisted his arms behind him. One of them clapped a firm hand over his mouth. Bronwyn stood frozen, her face so pale that Galrion was afraid she would faint.
I beg you, my liege, Geraint went on. If I allow this marriage, what kind of brother am I? How can I claim to be head of my clan if I have so little honour? My liege, if ever the Falcon has paid you any service, I beg you, don't let this happen.
Done, then,
Adoric said.
We hereby release you from your father's pledge.
Kero, Bronwyn sobbed out. You can't. I want to go, Kero. Let me go.
Hush.
Geraint rose, turning and sweeping her into his arms.
You don't understand. You don't know what kind of life you'll have, wandering the roads like beggars.
I don't care.
Bronwyn tried to struggle free.
Kero, Kero, how can you do this to me? Let me go.
Geraint weakened, then he tossed his head.
I won't. I won't have you die in childbirth some day just because your man doesn't have the price of a midwife or starve some winter on the road. I'd die myself first.
It was touching, perfectly said, but Galrion knew that Geraint was lying, that all those fine words were cruel, deadly poisoned lies. The Dwayoma was making him tremble and choke.
He bit his guard in the hand, but all he got for his effort was a blow on the head that made the world dance.
You're wrong, Gero.
Bronwyn struggled like a wild creature.
I know you're wrong. I want to go with him.
Right or wrong, I'm the Falcon now, and you're not disobeying me.
Bronwyn made one last wrench, but he was too strong for her. As he dragged her away bodily, she wept, sobbing hysterically and helplessly as Geraint shoved her into their tent. Adoric motioned to the guards to let Galrion go.
Get this Nevin out of my sight forever!
The king handed Galrion his dagger.
Here's the one weapon allowed to a banished man. You must have a horse or you wouldn't be here.
He took the pouch at his side and drew out a coin.
And here's the silver of a banished man.
He pressed the coin into Galrion's hand. Galrion glanced at it, then flung it into his father's face.
I'd rather starve.
As the guards fell back in front of him, Galrion strode out of the camp. At the top of the rise, he turned for a last look at Bronwyn's tent. Then he broke into a run, crashing through the underbrush, running across the road, and tripping at last to fall on his knees near the bay gelding. He wept, but for Bronwyn's sake, not his own.
2. The women's hall was sunny, and through the windows Bronwyn could see apple trees, so white with perfumed blossoms that it seemed clouds were caught in the branches. Nearby, Rother and Isola were talking as they worked at their sewing, but Bronwyn let her work lie in her lap. She wanted to weep, but it was so tedious to weep all the time. She prayed that Prince Galrion might be well, and wondered where he was riding on his lonely road of exile.
"Gwenny," Lady Rother said, "shall we walk in the meadows this afternoon?"
If you wish, my lady.
Well, if you'd rather, Gwenny, Isola put in, we could go riding.
Whatever you want.
Here, child, Rother said. Truly, it's time you got over this brooding. Your brother did what was best for you.
If my lady...